Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And as all of you must be aware by now, it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. That's the entire month of October, and we're inundated with pink imagery, pink ribbons, pink events, run for the cure, walk for the cure, what have you. And even when we watch sporting events, we see macho football players wearing pink gloves, baseball players slugging baseballs wearing pink batter's gloves. We are inundated with the message that it's important to think pink. But today I'm going to talk to someone who thinks that we should think before you pink. And she's part of Breast Cancer Action. She is Karuna Jagger. She's executive director of this organization, which is based in Berkeley, California. And she has a personal commitment to this. She looks at environmental factors as a critical factor in the development of breast cancer, and takes some, as you'll soon see, a slightly critical view of some of the mainstream efforts to raise awareness about breast cancer. Not that they're bad, but that we need a wider perspective. So welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's nice having you on the program, Karuna.
Oh, thanks so much for having me and for covering this important topic.
Yes. Okay, so you know, give us the framework. You're part of something called Breast Cancer Action, who have coined the term pink washing. What's that all about?
Yeah, so Breast Cancer Action is a national feminist grassroots education and advocacy organization, and we work both to address the needs of women living with the disease and also to stop breast cancer before it starts. And as you noted in your introduction, you know, October and increasingly year-round, we see many companies selling pink ribbon products in the name of breast cancer. Too many of those products that bear pink ribbons and are sold in the name of breast cancer actually contain the very chemicals that increase a woman's risk of the disease. And so Breast Cancer Action, we call those pink washers. We coined the phrase as part of our Think Before You Pink campaign. That was a program that we started in 2002 precisely in response to this overwhelming number of pink ribbon products flooding the market. And you know, we've been calling for accountability and transparency in all this breast cancer fundraising because after the billions, and it is billions with a B that's raised in the name of breast cancer, we simply have too little to show for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would certainly concur. The statistics suggest that fewer women are dying of their breast cancer, but that may be partially an artifact of the fact that more women are being diagnosed very, very early, perhaps with breast cancers that they might have survived anyway.
Well, yes. What you see is that the mortality rate has not been declining significantly. About 40,000 women, that is 40,000 women, will die of breast cancer this year alone, and that number has held relatively steady you know, for many years. And it is true that there has been increasing public discussion of overdiagnosis and overtreatment. And I think it is important that people understand that breast cancer is a term that describes a complex set of diseases. And there is not a single kind of breast cancer. That term describes cancers that occur in the breast, and the more we learn about breast cancer, the more we understand about the subtypes of breast cancer. And, you know, frankly, there are some cancers that we simply don't have effective treatments for, no matter how early they are detected.
Mm-hmm.
Those very aggressive breast cancers do not benefit from increased screening because we simply don't have the treatments that work for them. Then there are other breast cancers that are very slow growing and indolent and may never become life-threatening. And in those cases, we've seen, you know, increasing conversation about the fact that women are getting diagnosed and treated for breast cancer that may never become life-threatening, and we call that overdiagnosis and overtreatment, because their bodies and their finances and their psyches and their relationships are bearing all the toll of a breast cancer diagnosis. Yet, if those lesions, you know, either may self-resolve or may in fact remain local to the breast and never become life-threatening. And so it's only these intermediate breast cancers that in fact benefit from early detection. And so what people see is that, you know, the more we learn about mammography, it is not a, it is not the solution to the breast cancer epidemic. It misses too many cancers. It results in overdiagnosis and overtreatment, and many fewer lives are saved than women typically think, because the experience of many women is that, it, given the narrative, you know, early detection saves lives, if a woman is alive after a breast cancer that was found in a mammogram, the temptation is to say the mammogram saved my life, when that may in fact not be true.
And that also dovetails nicely with efforts to get all women to report for frequent mammograms, which is the theme of many of these campaigns. Not that we're saying that mammograms are bad, but the inordinate emphasis on mammograms may distract us from other important issues related to breast cancer.
Absolutely. After 50 years of research, there remains widespread disagreement on the benefit of mammography. It raises as many questions as it answers. And you know, the benefits of mammography have long been overstated, from those early days of breast cancer awareness campaigns that said, you know, early detection is your best prevention. Well, mammograms will never prevent breast cancer. At best, they will detect cancer after it has occurred. And as I said earlier, they miss too many cancers and they find too many lesions that are not, in fact, cancer or not, in fact, life-threatening. So as the watchdog of the breast cancer movement, it is really our job to look at all this data from a patient perspective, because too often the harms and the risks of mammography are left out of the conversation. And when you understand both the benefits and the risks, they look different from a patient perspective than from a provider's perspective. So the harms of overdiagnosis and overtreatment are harms that are borne by women. Women and their bodies and their finances and their relationships, and those harms are arguably benefits for providers who get paid.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. You mean, there's sort of this is almost an industry unto itself. You have charitable foundations which are ostensibly doing good. It's a feel good thing, and you have device makers. You know, certainly big companies like GE that manufacture the equipment. Ever more sophisticated equipment, now digital equipment to computer analyze mammograms. You have medical hospitals and doctors who are very happy to do case finding, because literally they are trolling for patients that they can treat aggressively, because that, unfortunately, in our medical system is the mainstay of medical economics, is high impact patients with serious diseases that require very, very dramatic interventions. And so you have kind of a situation where you have a lot of momentum that develops around this feel-good enterprise.
I can't argue with that. I think, you know, most people don't realize that Breast Cancer Awareness Month has been one big marketing campaign from the get-go, and arguably it's the most successful marketing campaign of the 20th century. Breast Cancer Awareness Month was launched by a pharmaceutical company. And few people realize that AstraZeneca, the pharmaceutical company that sells cancer treatments on the one hand and sells carcinogenic pesticides on the other hand, AstraZeneca created Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And that profit cycle of selling those chemicals that are linked to cancer and selling the drugs to treat cancer has long been you know, pointed out by breast cancer activists and Breast Cancer Action specifically. And if we separate Breast Cancer Awareness Month from the Pink Ribbon, you know, two kind of similar marketing campaigns that are in fact distinct, similarly, the Pink Ribbon was a marketing campaign that was dreamt up by Self Magazine and Estee Lauder Cosmetic Company. And it came out of a peach ribbon that was a grassroots activist tool to draw attention to cancer prevention. So there was a woman in the Midwest named Charlotte Haley, late late 80s, early 90s, who made national news. She was outraged by the fact that the National Cancer Institute allocated a mere 5% of research funding to cancer prevention. And she was seeing her family and her community diagnosed with breast cancer and was upset that at such a small percent was going to cancer prevention. So she created a peach-colored ribbon and started distributing it along with these cards that read, "Help wake up our legislators in America by wearing this ribbon." And she made national news. She's getting attention. So Self Magazine and Estee Lauder caught wind of this and reached out to her, and she declined to partner with them. She told them they were too corporate. And as large corporations, they had powerful, clever legal and marketing teams, and their legal team said to them that they simply needed to change the color. And mm-hmm. so they did focus groups mm-hmm. and found that pink was feminine and soothing and cheerful, you know, as many people say, everything that breast cancer is not.
Right.
And they rebranded mm-hmm. Charlotte Haley's peach cancer prevention ribbon mm-hmm. and in its place created the pink awareness ribbon.
Wow.
And that is why we call it Breast Cancer Industry Month, because it has always been a corporate marketing campaign and never truly been about women's health.
It's also a great way to show that you're a compassionate man to wear a pink ribbon, that you're manly enough and empathetic enough to want to promote that cause. So it works all the way around.
So, you know, there is a lot of conversation in the breast cancer community about the pink ribbon, and I do want to acknowledge that there are people who get comfort and feel sort of solidarity when they see a pink ribbon.
Mm-hmm.
And
no question, there's a lot of good that comes out of this.
And there are people who feel that their disease has been commodified, that corporations are profiteering off their mm-hmm. disease, that mm-hmm. this is empty tokenism. And so, you know, this is not about telling people what to think or what to feel. It's about calling for accountability and transparency in those breast cancer fundraising campaigns when you see pink ribbon products, providing people with some critical questions for conscious consumers so they can really peel back the pink ribbon and look to see, is this purchase having the impact that they think it will have, that they want it to have?
Well, let's take a look at some of the more egregious examples. You know, when I see a pink bucket of KFC chicken, I'm tempted to think that, maybe there's some corporate contributions going the way of breast cancer organizations. But basically, it's there to sell a lot of chicken, which may not be that beneficial for women's breast health.
Yes. So, you know, our Think Before You Pink campaign has been calling out pink washers successfully for years. And one of the campaigns that we launched, we called it What the Cluck. It was in response to Komen and KFC's partnership that they called Buckets for a Cure, where they sold fried chicken in the name of breast cancer. And, of course, pushing junk food in the name of breast cancer is outrageous. And, you know, Stephen Colbert picked it up and did a very fantastic spiel on cause marketing and just the hypocrisy of these corporations that are selling products linked to the problems that they claim to care about. And that really gets at the root of pinkwashing, which is you've got companies that are making money in the name of this disease, because when they're selling these pink ribbon products, not only are they making money from those pink ribbon products, but they're also making money through the research has shown cause marketing works. When companies brand themselves as caring about a cause, consumers respond both with those particular products, but also with broader customer loyalty. So these companies are making money on the pink ribbon products, but they're also making money through just increased sales because of brand loyalty. And they're not actually stepping up and ensuring that they are not contributing to the increased risk of the disease. So you've talked about Buckets for a Cure. There's another example that people know, which is Yoplait, mm-hmm. sold pink lidded yogurt for many years, still does. Mm-hmm. For many years, that yogurt was made using dairy stimulated with a synthetic growth hormone, RBGH. And RBGH is linked to increased risk for breast cancer and other health harms. And so we launched a campaign called Put a Lid on It. Mm-hmm. And called on Yoplait to drop dairy that was stimulated with RBGH. And ultimately, Yoplait and Danone both stopped making their yogurt with RBGH stimulated dairy.
Yeah, and the idea behind that for our listening audience is that this is, I mean, I just talked to a guy who he's the son of a dairy farmer. He decided to go into veterinary medicine, but he was explaining the dairy industry that the average cow could produce a finite amount of milk in, say, the 1950s, maybe 50 gallons of milk over a week. The average cow now is approaching the threshold of producing 300 gallons of milk per week. They're turning cows into milk factories. And how do they do that? They stimulate or overstimulate their mammary glands to overproduce milk. The concern is that the milk may contain residues of something that's highly stimulatory to the mammary gland, and that is not going to be great when it comes to breast cancer if you drink a lot of that milk.
Yep. There's a complex mechanism where RBGH converts into insulin growth factor 1, and indeed, it is linked to a range of health harms, including breast cancer. And as we know, breast cancer is a hormone-sensitive disease. It's a hormone-stimulated disease. Another example, since if you would like, is Komen produced for a little less than 1 year a perfume. They commissioned it, so it's different than other cause marketing in that this was actually not just a product that existed, that a portion of the proceeds went to the breast cancer organization. This was a breast cancer organization actually commissioning a perfume. And independent lab testing showed that that perfume contained hormone disruptors and other chemicals of concern. And, when we reached out to Komen to let them know and asked them to remove the product from the shelves, they didn't immediately respond. And so we launched a campaign called Raise a Stink. And ultimately, consumer pressure take its people organized, and Komen did respond and ended that partnership as well. So we've been going after pink washers one by one for years. And the question here is, we are in a unique moment in time where environmental health activists, environmentalists, and industry are all agreed that it is time for comprehensive chemical reform. We need to update TSCA, the Toxic Substance Control Act of 1976, that is out of date. And we've got this momentum right now to pass chemical reform. And because industry has introduced an industry-friendly bill, we know that industry's idea of chemical reform looks very different from the idea of women living with an at-risk of breast cancer. And so this is the time to go toe-to-toe with industry and say we need to protect public health before harm occurs, and we need to put an end to pinkwashing once and for all and make sure no product, whether it bears a pink ribbon or not, contains these chemicals that increase our risk of breast cancer and other diseases.
Well, other concerns are, with the ethics of these programs and, where does the money go? Does any money from a purchase or substantial amounts of money actually go to bona fide breast cancer programs? And if so, what percentage? Is it tiny? Is it significant?
Yeah. So nobody knows. So those follow the money questions are really good questions. And nobody regulates the pink ribbon. Anyone can put it on anything, and they do. And so you see pink ribbons on handguns, pink ribbons on okay. garbage trucks and fire trucks.
Well, it's true that it's true that handguns have not been directly linked to breast cancer. I mean, perhaps the lead from the bullets may have an impact on breast cancer, but I'm just being facetious there.
Sure. So I'm sort of separating here. I think it is important to talk about cause marketing in general. So that is, selling a product in the name of a particular charitable cause, and this is part of what I'm about to talk about, and pinkwashing specifically. So that is the hypocrisy of products that themselves contain chemicals that increase a woman's risk of the disease. But there are legitimate questions, even if a product is not pinkwashing. And I think, you know, to your point, while nobody would want to push handguns for health, and there's a hypocrisy there, handguns themselves don't necessarily increase the risk of the disease. My point there is about the accountability and transparency.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can put a pink ribbon on anything, and very right. often those garbage trucks, and we're talking municipal garbage trucks or fire trucks or garbage cans or T-shirts or, you know, cosmetic shampoos or handguns or whatever it is, very often the pink ribbon is meant to be the sign of awareness, and no money is donated to any breast cancer program.
Right.
In other cases, pennies on the dollar is donated to a breast cancer program. So the first question for consumers to ask when they're looking at a pink ribbon product and considering a purchase is, does any money go to a breast cancer program? And if so, how much?
Mm-hmm.
And is that enough? Are you better off donating directly to an organization that is doing the work that you think is important because perhaps a corporation is actually pocketing your good intentions? So questions about, is money donated to a breast cancer program? If so, which breast cancer program? Perhaps you were able to, you know, you feel satisfied that the money is going, that a decent amount of money is going to a breast cancer program. What is that? What is the organization and what are they doing? Are they really, you know, providing more awareness?
Right.
Or are they doing something that gets at the root causes of the disease or addresses the needs of women living with the disease? Because arguably, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody in 2013 who is not aware of breast cancer. Do we need more awareness or do we need some action?
Well, you mentioned in the introduction that your organization had feminist roots, and this really seems like a very interesting perspective on feminism, is that women, in this case, are being exploited, literally, to promote commerce and to promote a cause which is of, in some cases, mixed or dubious benefit.
Yes, I think that's, you know, certainly we believe that women deserve better, that we all deserve better, that, you know, this again goes to the accountability and transparency. The public cares about breast cancer, and we should, and we need to see more effective, less toxic treatments that extend the life and improve the quality of life of women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer. We need to understand the root causes of this disease. Despite the billions spent on breast cancer, we still can't explain more than half of all breast cancers. You know, the first thing somebody says to me when they tell me about a breast cancer diagnosis, more often than not, they'll say, and there wasn't even a family history. Well, just 10% of all breast cancers actually are linked to family history, so it's less likely rather than more likely that there would be a hereditary link, and yet that's what people think. And so when you look at family history, BRCA mutations, age of menarche and menopause, whether somebody drank alcohol, postmenopausal weight gain, smoking, you know, did somebody breastfeed, what age did she give birth if she gave birth, if you look at everything we know about breast cancer, we can explain less than half of all breast cancers, and that's simply unacceptable at this stage. So in terms of us as a feminist organization, yes, we believe that women organizing together can, you know, we deserve more, and we can organize and we can get it. I also think that we don't blame women for their breast cancer, and this is important. There are so many organizations that focus on what they call prevention. And there are, you know, arguably some risk reduction strategies that are lifestyle strategies, but ultimately the takeaway message that women get is that they're to blame for their own breast cancer, that they didn't exercise enough.
Right.
That they,
this is often pervade in the guise of empowerment, that, you know, you can take responsibility for your health. However, if you fail, you feel like a dismal failure.
Yeah. And I think, you know, exactly. So we see this with mainstream breast cancer organizations, that the message is sort of control your weight, exercise, don't drink to excess, don't smoke, and get your mammogram, right? That's the mainstream message. And,
right.
And you know, clearly that's not
Also with exercise being a theme, and exercise is, there's no question, studies are showing that exercise is beneficial.
Sure. And women who exercise get breast cancer.
Indeed.
And so this goes back to the root causes of this disease.
Right.
Absolutely. I hope that people have opportunities to make healthy choices and you know, feel good about their bodies and, you know, exercise and eat healthy. Sure, that's a good thing. But that, our message around breast cancer prevention has to go deeper than that, because there are too many people who are, you know, doing all the right things and still get diagnosed, and the evidence points to the environmental links to the disease. And I want to be clear here as well that many environmental health organizations, again, put the burden on women and make lists of products or foods that you should and shouldn't eat or should and shouldn't buy. And in fact, you know, again, of course, make healthy choices if you can, but we need to do two things. We need to make sure that all people have access to healthy food and nobody is exposed to harmful chemicals just because they don't have the knowledge or the purchasing power to buy the so-called safer alternative, right?
Right.
And we need to get away from this individualistic thinking that we can be our own EPA and FDA and the problem is solved. You know, the fact of the matter is consumer purchases represent a portion of our overall body burden. We, you know, if you drive your Prius, we're all breathing everybody else's auto exhaust, you
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
and we share common environments in our workplaces, in our schools, in our parks and playgrounds, you know, our food, our air, our water. And if you have concern about a particular chemical, I, you know, what Breast Cancer Action works to do is to provide all of us with the tools to make sure that no one is exposed, so that we're not individually trying to be our own, you know, EPA, FDA, but that we are actually holding our regulatory system accountable to protecting all of us and improving everyone's health, so that we're not widening a health gap, but we're improving public health overall.
Oh, that's a great message. What? Tell us a little bit. You introduced the term endocrine disruptors. Some of our listeners are very familiar with that concept. But talk to us about endocrine disruptors, and maybe you can comment on another term, xenoestrogens.
Yeah. So there is a growing body of research that points to chemicals in our daily lives which mimic our hormones and change and stimulate our hormones. And the mechanisms of this is not always well stood. So endocrine disruptors are basically hormone disruptors. And, you know, it's worth noting that some breast cancer treatments are hormone disruptors. Breast cancer is a hormone-driven disease, and so one of the treatments for some hormone-sensitive breast cancers, and this is going to kind of get into the subtypes of breast cancer again, understanding that breast cancer is a term that describes a complex set of diseases. Hormone-sensitive breast cancer, ER, PR-positive breast cancer, those are breast cancers that are the most common, are treated with tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors, and these actually block, they do different things, but let's for now just say they block estrogen processing. it's a
right.
little bit complicated.
But it's complicated because there are so many different types of estrogen receptors in the body that well, some drugs block estrogen receptors. They may activate uterine receptors, thus increasing the risk of uterine cancer. So it's complicated.
Exactly.
That's, yeah.
You know, tamoxifen absolutely does decrease the risk of breast cancer and increases the risk of uterine cancer. So, you know, our hormone system is a complex system. It is not well understood, but we do know that breast cancer is a hormone-driven disease, and there is a growing body of evidence that the hormone disruptors that we are exposed to in our daily lives are linked to breast cancer and other hormone-related problems, and also that these drugs, these chemicals, like BPA, in fact, can interfere with breast cancer treatments. So there's lab evidence that BPA interferes with tamoxifen's efficacy. So this is, you know, this question of the chemicals that we're exposed to in our daily lives is both about cancer prevention, but it's also about cancer treatment and cancer recurrence. And so, you know, we are we need to shift how we think about toxicology. In the past, toxicology has really been seen as a dose response where there's a linear, where basically anything can be toxic. Even water can be toxic at high enough dose. And so the study of toxicology has historically been figuring out the
What's the threshold, in other words?
Exactly.
You know, it's
exactly.
Like, what's the safe level of this toxin? And of which
Excuse
is kind
me,
of a
exactly.
non sequitur. You know, what is a safe level of something that could be extremely dangerous at infinitesimal doses, or might interact harmfully with 12 other agents to produce cancer?
And that's the limit of toxicology as it has been understood for many years, and that is that some of these endocrine disruptors, these hormone disruptors, actually there's evidence that shows that they may be most impactful in our bodies at the lowest doses, because at the lowest doses, they sort of bypass the body's detection system. The body mistakes them for naturally occurring hormones and responds, whereas at high doses, the body recognizes that's synthetic, that's foreign, and doesn't get triggered. And so, you know, hormone disruptors sort of turn toxicology on its head.
Get under the radar.
Force us to think about this in different ways. And I think, you know, very much to your point, we are all exposed to unknown chemicals in unknown quantities and unknown combinations throughout our daily lives. There are more than 80,000 chemicals in use in the United States, a minority of which have ever been safety tested. And we have an innocent until proven guilty chemical policy here in the U.S., where we, you know, assume that chemicals are okay, and they're, you know, contrary to what most people expect and believe, these chemicals are not safety tested before they are introduced into our daily lives. And so we're really looking to change that and to demand that industry do safety testing before these chemicals go into use, so that we are preventing harm before it occurs. It's very, very hard to do environmental health studies. You know, the body is complex. These chemicals, such as hormone disruptors, you know, what some of these hormone disruptors do is change breast development, which creates an organ which is then more sensitive to chemicals down the road. You know, so the research is showing that breast cancer is it's a lifetime exposures issue.
And it may begin before lifetime. It may be a preconceptual issue too.
Yes, yes. And so we need to get away from this idea that random controlled experiments are the gold standard of causal effect, because first of all, there is no control in our modern lives. Everybody is exposed to these chemicals, and in many cases, it's hard to find people that don't have body burden on some of these chemicals, so we don't have a control. But furthermore, we're simply not going to experiment on humans. We're not going to expose humans to chemicals that we know or suspect to
right.
cause harm.
That would be like the Tuskegee syphilis study all over again.
Correct. And so, you know, in light of that, we're not going to do random controlled experiments, and so we therefore must be willing to accept other sources of data, which include animal data and include lab mm-hmm. data. And yes, there are questions that we can raise about that data, but those data are the best evidence that we have, given we're not going to do experiments on humans. And they're really, we should be protecting public health in light of the data that we do have, in light of what we do know. It's called the precautionary principle, and it means we should be preventing harm before it occurs.
Right. To switch gears slightly, where would you like to see research go on diet? Do you think that there are any particular dietary culprits that have not been identified by the powers that be when they dispense their usual dietary advice?
So, again, Breast Cancer Action really looks at systemic-level interventions rather than lifestyle interventions. And so the places where we've gotten involved with diet are things like RBGH or our food packaging, right, the chemicals that or pesticides, you know. So we want to make sure that food is safe and healthy for people, and that, you know, we aren't exposed to chemicals either through food production or food packaging when these chemicals really do, there's this growing body of evidence implicating them.
Right. So, in short, there's a call to action of, since we're all, they certainly got our attention with all those pink items this October. But your call to action is let's think a little bit more deeply about this and in a more sophisticated way about the complexity of breast cancer and not just opt for the usual mantra of get a mammogram, eat well, lose weight, make sure you exercise, and take a look at some of the other factors that may be involved.
Absolutely. So, if somebody is, concerned about breast cancer and wants to give, and after this conversation has some doubts about pink ribbon purchasing, we encourage people to give directly to those organizations that are doing the work that matters to you, whether it's emergency services for low-income women who don't have basic bus fare, whether it's research into new and better treatments or complementary therapies, whether it is research into prevention. Too little money goes into true primary prevention and the environmental link to the disease, or whether it's advocacy and watchdog like our work. Give directly to the organizations that are doing the work that you think is most important and hold companies accountable for their role in the epidemic rather than giving them a pass when you see a pink ribbon product.
One final issue that I want to broach with you is you have a section at Breast Cancer Action. By the way, the website is bcaction.org. Great website. Where you take issue with human gene patents. Now, what the heck does that have to do with breast cancer?
Yes. Well, this is shocking to many people. So in the mid-1990s, one company patented and did successfully patent, was granted a patent by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, two patents, one on the BRCA1 and another on the BRCA2 genes. These are known as the human breast cancer genes. And we talked earlier about the hereditary risk of breast cancer. And again,
that's the Angela Jolie story in a nutshell.
Correct.
That she had one or both of these be high risk.
Exactly. She has a BRCA1 mutation. So a minority of breast cancers are linked to these BRCA mutations. But when a woman has a BRCA mutation, her risk of breast and ovarian and some other cancers is very, very high. So, where for the general population it may be a 1 in 8 chance of getting breast cancer over the course of a woman's life, for a woman with a BRCA1 mutation, it's inverted. It's a 7 in 8 chance of getting breast cancer over the course of her life, roughly. So, very high risk of breast cancer, much higher than the general population. When people talk high risk, this is a different ballgame altogether.
So you don't have a problem with them detecting this risk. That's not what you're...
So the problem is that one company successfully patented these two human genes. And because of their patent on the human genes, they were able to... They had a monopoly on this test, which is a test that offers potentially life-saving information. So at a time when the cost of the technology was declining rapidly, the cost of the test doubled. This one company makes more than $500 million a year off of this test and takes all this biodata that it collects, all this family history, the genetic test, the blood sample, and they hoard all that biodata.
In secret to perform their own profit-driven research.
Correct. And this, we believe that these tests should follow medical ethics standards like other medical tests and devices and medical research, and should be a resource for humanity, for the benefit of humanity. So in 2009, we joined a lawsuit with other geneticists and researchers, some affected women. We were the only breast cancer organization to get involved because, and part of our corporate contributions policy, ACLU were the lawyers. They did a brilliant job arguing the case in 2009, and we followed it through the courts. So in 2009, when we started this, people thought this was a frivolous case. They thought it would go nowhere, and they said, well, clearly companies can patent human genes because the Patent and Trademark Office granted these patents. We thought that was wrong. And the case wound its way through the legal system. And in the spring, on tax day, actually, April 15th, we went to the Supreme Court. It was there. It was exciting. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments. And in June, the Supreme Court ruled in our favor and both outlawed took away Myriad's patents on the human BRCA1 and 2 genes and ruled broadly that naturally occurring DNA, so that is DNA in human, plants, and animals, is not patent eligible. It cannot be patented by single companies. So it's a profound ruling that has broad impact and has been very important for the breast cancer community.
Yeah, well, I think that that's a great initiative, and I think it's also going to save us a lot of trouble down the line because all kinds of bioengineering projects will be undertaken in the future, and we want them to advance the cause of humanity and not just drive corporate profits.
I agree.
Right, so great. So for more information about the Think Before You Pink campaign, bcaction.org, you've got another website as well?
Yes, so bcaction.org is our main website. We do have our thinkbeforeyoupink.org website. So thinkbeforeyoupink.org is that program, and bcaction.org is our full organization's website. You can get a range of resources, information there, critical questions for consumers, our Think Before You Pink toolkit. We have webinars that are archived and a whole bunch of resources.
And by the way, you don't shut down on November 1st. It's all year-round.
We don't shut down. We are, breast cancer is a year-round disease. We are running a campaign right now called Toxic Time is Up. We are calling for comprehensive chemical reform, and I urge your listeners to join our movement for common sense cancer prevention, to go to our website and to sign our petition called Toxic Time is Up and join us in putting patient health first.
Well, great. Fantastic. Congratulations, Corinna Jagger, and your organization's doing fantastic work to raise awareness and to move us off this, in some ways, commercialized effort to harness the feel-good thing about breast cancer. We want to make sure that, indeed, there's awareness, but also that there's effective action. Thanks for joining us on today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and join us again for our next edition of Intelligent Medicine.